One of the abidingly fascinating things about St. Augustine is that he was a man who lived through the death of one society and the beginnings of the birth of another. His best modern biographer has pointed out that he began as a man of the classical world, acquiring a standard classical education and hoping for a career within the structures of the Roman Empire. He died as the Dark Ages were beginning. Tribes from Northern Europe, from Central Asia, had swept across Europe and across North Africa. His whole world was falling apart. And as he dies, the Vandals are besieging the city where he lives, and his world has ended, in effect. But much of his world had already ended some years before, when Rome, the capital of the empire, had been sacked by the Goths, and refugees had streamed from Italy into North Africa. And Augustine had to cope with people who were displaced both mentally and spiritually, as well as physically. So as a man who stands in the middle of a fragmenting, a decaying society, he's a man who has something to say to people who sense that today they live at the beginning of a sort of ending. People who are aware that society as they know it is collapsing, reforming, and the future is very uncertain. Whether that's because we look at our looming ecological crises, whether it's because we're looking at the rise of new kinds of barbarism through the threat of terror around us, something in St. Augustine's world is bound to ring bells with us today. And to listen to someone who's thinking aloud over many decades about issues like this can still be an intensely moving and engaging experience. Moving and engaging, because Augustine is never a dry writer. One of the most significant things about him, simply as a writer, is his ability to tap into levels of interiority, levels of the inner life, which were more or less unknown in literature before his day.
These actions are inward, in the vast hall of my memory. There, sky, land, and sea are available to me, together with all the sensations I have been able to experience in them, except for those which I have forgotten. There also I meet myself, and recall what I am, what I have done, and when, and where, and how I was affected when I did it. There is everything that I remember, whether I experienced it directly or believed the word of others. Out of the same abundance in store, I combine with past events images of various things, whether experienced directly or believed on the basis of what I have experienced. And on this basis, I reason about future actions and events and hopes, and again think of all these things in the present. I shall do this and that, I say to myself, within that vast recess of my mind, which is full of many rich images, and this act or that follows. Oh, that this or that were so! May God avert this or that! I say these words to myself, and as I speak, there are present images of everything that I am speaking of, drawn out of the same treasure house of memory. I would never say anything like that if these images were not present.
Before Augustine's time, there had been writers in Greek and Latin who talked about their personal experience, who talked about the formation of the self and its feelings, but nobody does it in quite the way that Augustine does. When he first published his Confessions, he was doing something which, in a literary sense, was quite new. He was describing, step by step, the formation of a human awareness. He's the first writer in European history to think seriously about the experience of children. It's something that's not often noted about his work, but it is one of the most seriously innovative things that he does. He looks back and searches around to try and remember what it was like to be a child in the cradle, what it was like to be an envious child, wanting what other children had, to be anxious about his parents and their love. He looks at the beginnings of friendship, at the pressures of being at school, and he writes about them with a kind of openness and candour that no other writer of his period or earlier even begins to rival. So, as some people have put it, he's almost inventing the Western self, the self-examining, self-exploring psychology of Western humanity. A lot of his legacy in the Middle Ages had to do with that. He was remembered and he was studied as somebody who had explored the idea of memory, what he sometimes called the caverns of memory within the psyche. Someone who explored the strange paradoxes of not quite being able to remember what you knew that you knew. What was it, he asked himself, what was it to remember the words of a song as you were singing them? But he also wrote about memory as a place where you find God. For him, the deeper you went into your understanding of yourself, the deeper you went into the mystery of God. Because as you began to understand what kind of a thing you were as a human being, a human mind and heart, you began to understand what spiritual reality was. You began to get some sense of the rhythm and the depth of that life that sustains everything. And so in his greatest and longest, and it must be admitted, most difficult speculative work on the doctrine of the Trinity, he ends up thinking about thinking itself, thinking about what it's like to know that you are a remembering, an understanding, a loving person, and seeing those three characteristics as the essentially human, and because they're essentially human, giving you, strangely, a clue as to what was essentially divine. He's a remarkably un-messianic sort of writer, Augustine. He doesn't let you get away with any sorts of illusion about Christian individuals or Christian societies. And one of the things he often insists on in his writing against some other, rather more optimistic Christians is, don't expect to arrive at a situation where sin is all behind you. There's always tomorrow, and things can go really badly wrong tomorrow. And in his Confessions, writing as a respected and well-known bishop and teacher, he admits that he still doesn't know whether he's going to be able in the long run to conquer his passions and his lusts, whether he can really settle into being a disciple of Christ. And it's that feeling of human fragility, of a life that's still in formation, that sense of an unknown, exciting and also threatening human future, that's again one of the things that makes him sound very contemporary. He writes about desire. He writes about the unfinished quality of human life, and writes about it in deeply moving and striking ways. And it's in that light, in that context, that one ought to understand some of what Augustine has to say about original sin. He's had a very, very bad press for over 100 years, because he's thought of as the person who invented original sin, and often he's thought of as the person who invented the idea that original sin had something to do with sex. Neither of these accusations is anything like true. What preoccupied Augustine was the sense that when we made our choices, we weren't ever acting in a vacuum. We were inheriting the whole history of human choice going right back to the beginnings of the human race, and so we were inheritors of all the ways in which things had gone wrong across the centuries. That's original sin. Nobody starts with a clean slate. Everybody starts, so to speak, in debt. And his attitude to sexuality, well, it wasn't something that he found easy at all. He'd had a fairly dramatic youth himself, and he tells us about it in the Confessions a bit. He'd lived with a woman for 10 years, and they'd had a child together. And he writes about that with great poignancy and a kind of lip-biting restraint in the Confessions, as if some bits of that are still too painful for him to be honest about. It certainly means that Augustine doesn't regard sexuality as a straightforward area of human experience, and there are some of his late writings especially where he seems to load on it a great deal of threat and anxiety. And yet, in comparison with many Christian writers of the same age, he's amazingly relaxed. He certainly doesn't think it's the only sin. He certainly believed that sexuality between married couples was a kind of foretaste of the harmony of heaven, which is very startling when you think of some of what other people were writing at the same time. But he does see sexual greed, what he calls concupiscence, lust, as really one of the most fundamental forms of human wrongness. Because what could, in a sense, be more humanly wrong than having an acquisitive greed for somebody else's human reality? That's how he sees lust. And perhaps that's why he sees it as so central in his map of the moral world at times. He was somebody who was deeply aware both of the unfinished quality of the world itself as well as of human beings, and yet deeply aware of its beauty. And there's a real tension sometimes in his writing. Beauty is a crucial notion for him. And yet, the beauty of this world is always something that prompts you and stirs you to go a bit further. The beauty of a human friendship, a human relationship, is a wonderful, indispensable thing. He was a great believer in friendship. And yet, it itself is something that opens out onto a wider horizon. In all these ways, he's a man of huge psychological complexity. And some torment and imbalance, of course. I don't imagine he was an easy man. And yet, he's a man whose writings take us deeper into the sense of what it is to be a human self than anyone of his age. And he does it also by means of a remarkable flexibility in his very use of language. He writes at least three different kinds of Latin. He can do classical Latin, standing on his head. He was trained to do that. He knows what it's like to construct a good classical argument in fine resounding prose, and when he writes his treatise on The City of God, his great work on political theology, he does it mostly in Ciceronian Latin. This is the powerful, resonant, formal language of the law courts and public oratory. But turn from that to his confessions, and you find that he's invented a completely different kind of Latin. It's thoughtful, rhythmical, poetical. He begins lots of sentences with "and" to intensify the rhythm. He weaves phrases from the Bible and especially from the Psalms in and out of his exposition, in and out of his introspection. And the result is a sort of musical Latin, quite unlike what he writes in other contexts. It's a Latin for quiet and solitary reflection, a Latin almost for singing to yourself.
Late have I loved you, beauty so old and so new. Late have I loved you. And see, you were within, and I was in the external world, and sought you there. And in my unlovely state, I plunged into those lovely created things which you made. You were with me, and I was not with you. The lovely things kept me far from you, though if they did not have their existence in you, they had no existence at all. You called and cried out loud and shattered my deafness. You were radiant and resplendent. You put to flight my blindness. You were fragrant, and I drew in my breath, and now I pant after you. I tasted you, and now I feel but hunger and thirst for you. You touched me, and I am set on fire to attain the peace which is yours.
Not many people manage to write in so many different styles with such power and success. But Augustine, as a Latin writer, is, among other things, a reminder of the powerful variety that Latin can make possible. It's not just a language for one context. Just as in classical Latin, a Horace, a Virgil, and a Catullus will sound completely different as poets, so in this one person, Augustine, you can have the meditative, introspective Augustine, the poet and mystic, the orator, the public man, trying to sound really convincing to a not terribly sympathetic secular audience when he writes about the City of God, and then the Christian pastor, thinking out loud about the Bible. It wouldn't quite be right to say that Augustine never wrote a dull page. Everybody does. And there are some tracts of Augustine's prose that are very hard going, and where you feel the engine is idling. And is most intense, I think that all Latin prose writers, he's perhaps the one who makes the nerves tingle most at his best. The one who gives you a sense of the language itself as expressing desire, excitement, love, self-awareness. And that's one of the things that makes him such a great writer and such a great figure in the Christian church.